Welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast, where our job is to help you build visibility, professional credibility, and connection with your ideal client by putting the human at the center of innovative marketing, so you can build and strengthen an engaging, enduring relationship with your ideal clients. I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm honored that you're here with me. If you haven't joined our wonderful marketing transformation community yet, go to innovabiz.co and collect your free gift as well. Do subscribe to the show and also leave a review because it helps others find us. Let's get into today's masterclass on this InnovaBuzz podcast.
Really value other people and to consider them in the process and consider their problems, consider how they feel about their problems and what it means for them to have their problem solved. And really just being curious about that. I think it would be easy to assume that you know what problem they have and how it should be solved. But I think taking the time to get curious, to ask questions, to know what their experience of a problem being solved is, I think will only bring about really valuable insight.
Welcome back. It's that time of the week again, and I hope you've had an awesome week so far. If you haven't listened to my recent podcast conversations with communication specialist Janice Tomich and with Neil Butler of Untypical, then you must check them out, but only after you've listened to today's conversation. I'm really excited to have on the InnovaBuzz podcast as my guest today, Creative Director of Digital Brand and Marketing Agency 1-2, Marcel McCarthy. Marcel believes in a digital minimalist approach with a focus on results that genuinely make an impact on people's lives and on their business. He says he's driven by helping people, by riding bikes and drinking coffee. Yes, sounds like my kind of person. In our discussion today, Marcel talked to me about having a mindset of always improving. We talked about retail moving to become more omnichannel and about moving from appreciation to curiosity. Without further ado, then let's fly into the hive and get the buzz from Marcel McCarthy. Hi, I'm your host, Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm really excited to welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast today from Melbourne, Australia, Marcel McCarthy, who's the creative director of 1-2 and also publisher of The Ninch. 1-2 is a digital brand and marketing agency helping people and businesses thrive. So welcome to the podcast, Marcel. It's a great privilege to have you as my guest.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It's exciting to be here and have a chat.
Sam Keck, who was our guest on episode 299 of the InnovaBuzz podcast, suggested that we get you on the show and have a chat. So a big hello to Sam.
Hey, Sam. He's a good dude.
Now, you're originally from New Zealand, I believe, and also you kind of started out in the music industry. So how did you go from the music industry and from New Zealand to Melbourne and into digital marketing and design?
Yeah, well, it is quite an interesting story, I think. I grew up in New Zealand, so I was born in New Zealand, and I basically lived the first 18 years of my life in a little town called Katikati, which the Maori kind of translation of that comes across as Nibble Nibble, and that was basically because the Maori chief came up the main river and had a bite to eat and said Nibble Nibble, and thus Katikati was named. And so, yeah, it's a really beautiful part of New Zealand, estuaries and harbours and lots of people doing fishing and hunting. But it's a really small town, around 3,000 people. So that was kind of, I guess, my childhood.
North or South Island?
North Island. So it's about 2.5 hours southeast of Auckland.
Okay.
On the east coast there. So If anyone knows about the Coromandel Peninsula, it's right at the very base of the Coromandel Peninsula. But yeah, lovely spot. And yeah, that's kind of where I got started. And, you know, through high school, I guess, found music, really enjoyed music. And I think as a 13-year-old, I was like, oh, I'm going to be a rock star, or, you know, I had big dreams of doing music. And I think I just discovered music as something that I really enjoyed, and, you know, learning guitar. And I'd started picking up instruments here, there, and everywhere. I was playing bass in the jazz band. I was playing the glockenspiel in the concert band. We were writing music together with some friends. And it was just a really great experience. And I think out of that, I, you know, as it started coming to that time of my life where I was trying to work out what I wanted to pursue and what life might look like practically, I thought, huh, I really do enjoy music. What about studying it? And I never really wanted to be necessarily a performer. I always had this kind of interest in the business side of music and the kind of creative process, but not necessarily like I didn't want to be the world's most amazing guitar player. But I just really kind of liked what the music industry was about, or at least I thought I did. Anyway, how I got to Melbourne is that there was no courses in New Zealand that were kind of, they're all basically performance-based, and I was looking for a more industry-based course, you know, looking into the business and marketing and administration side of the music industry. And so anyway, I found myself in Melbourne studying basically a bachelor's degree in music industry. And through all of that, great experience, really enjoyed it. My dad always said, the best thing a degree will teach you is showing up and completing something. And I think that was probably the most valuable thing that I did get out of that degree practically now. But when it kind of came to the end of my time there, I was thinking about going to work for basically a music recording company. And I kind of missed out on that opportunity, and I had a few opportunities in the music publishing space as well. And for whatever reason, it just didn't jam, wasn't really into it. And I guess the people weren't quite what I was expecting out of that. And so I was like, oh, now what am I going to do? I'm 21. I've done a degree. I felt like I've wasted my life. I'm not going to end up in the industry that I thought I was going to be in. So what do I do now? And I think I hit the trough of sorrows rather, and ended up working as a barista for a little bit. And in the background of all of this, I'd always been really into creativity and photography and design, making websites. I'd never really considered it as a, I guess, career option or a job or something to pursue. But I think I kind of found myself there as people would slowly come up and ask me, hey, would you be able to help me with this? I know you're kind of into X, Y, and Z when it comes to the online space. You seem to know what you're talking about. Would you be able to help? And I was like, sure. Okay. So I was part-time barista, part-time helping friends out doing web projects. And that's actually how, in one part, Sam Kick and I connected, is that he asked me to help build Common Folk Coffee's website. And so I was like, sure, Sam, I'll be able to help you out. Don't worry about it. And so I helped him. And then all of a sudden, people who I had no idea who they were asking me to help them make a website and help with their branding and their marketing plans. And I thought, huh, maybe there's something here. So I feel like I'm the unintentional, accidental entrepreneur, and I've kind of been, you know, forced into it. Sam always likes to say that he started one too and got us going, but it is very funny. So anyway, it just did really feel like a natural inclination, and all of a sudden I was working full-time for myself, running a little digital and branding agency, and I was like, oh, this is really fun. Really enjoyed it, really enjoyed the dynamic that I had with clients, being able to help them practically with their businesses. And so that was really rewarding. And that's, I guess, in part, that's kind of how I started. It was accidental and unintentional.
So at what point did you kind of realize, hey, this is a potential business and I need to get it sort of organized rather than just allowing people to come up and ask you for a favor and you'd fulfill that favor, presumably, or charging for that. But at what point did you say, well, let's structure this properly and brand it and build our own website and then actually do some marketing to generate business going forward and use it as a full-time job, if you like, or full-time activity?
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, on that unintentional element, I think I really do feel like on some degree, I just did stumble into it. And, you know, it really did feel quite natural. I wouldn't say there was one particular point where I woke up and said, hey, 1, 2, this is the thing. This is what I'm going to spend with my time. This is what I'm giving myself to career-wise. I think, if anything, I became more convinced that this was something that I would like to do and spend time on as I spent more time on it. I started going, wow, this is really amazing. I really appreciate the opportunities that I was having to learn, to grow, to work with people, and to kind of explore. I think I'm quite curious by nature and quite inquisitive. I like to know how things work. And, you know, I think with that and this kind of passion, I guess, of helping people, it really did kind of transition quite naturally. And then all of a sudden I was like, oh, you know, I guess thankfully as well, I seem to cross between the creative and the logical side quite well. And so I got to a point where I was like, oh, okay, I've kind of got this creative application thing down. I can deliver a project. But like you said, like, I needed to formalize a few things myself. Like, what are we trying to say? What are we trying to communicate? What kind of people do we like to work with? How do we want to be seen in this space? And so I think really I just set out on that journey of building something that was simple. I didn't want to overcomplicate it or confuse people, but just something that was genuine. And at the core of it was basically our messaging was built around how do we help people. And I think that really resonated particularly well with our local audience. We weren't trying to pretend to be anything. Like sometimes in agency world, there's a lot of people posing, a lot of people pretending to be things that they're not necessarily are. And I think we kind of took the lowly path, so to speak, and just really set out on helping people. And I guess in terms of the marketing side of things, like in our experience, just, you know, people really do love sharing a good experience and do really want to get behind someone, whether it's a small business or just someone who's passionate about something. I think people do genuinely love that. And so we've been just so, I guess you'd call it blessed. We've just received so much from the community around us as people were able to engage with us and they had a really positive experience. They got a really good result and that they would share that to others. And so I think, if anything, part of our core offering was just to really make a really good product, to make sure people felt that it was really good. And in large part, we've built a lot of the sustainability around our business around people having a really positive experience and just sharing that with other people who are like them. I think in that way, we've been able to work with some businesses that have really great alignment. I think, you know, oftentimes I've seen businesses who have maybe pursued a more aggressive paid marketing strategy and left out some of the softer elements, and they end up having to work with these crazy, different, distinct businesses who have, you know, they're kind of wacky fringe case businesses and, like, you know, sure, you could deliver a product, but it's maybe not in your preferred kind of area of expertise. And so I think because of that, we've been very lucky to just work with people who share a lot of values, and, you know, it just made it really easy to work with. Mm.
Yeah, there's so much to love about that, though. It's in terms of process. I mean, you've kind of outlined it that it's happened naturally, it's evolved, but in terms of process, it's focused on, first of all, connecting at a human level with the right people, people that you like to do business with. So you've got clarity around who is it you like to do business with, then delivering a great outcome for them, focused on delivering results, but also the experience. And then having those people talk about that positive experience to similar businesses. So I really like the whole approach. And as you mentioned, you know, if we chase anybody and everybody in business, I mean, we find often, and I've made this mistake before, it's not that, you know, this is something that I'm an expert on, but I've certainly made the mistake often enough to know that, you know, you can get yourself in a position where you're doing the work, you get resentful of the work, you get resentful of the customer calling you and saying, I want you to change this, or I've changed my mind, or I'm wanting to change direction. And then it turns out a bad experience all around, even though, you know, what the customer's expecting might be perfectly reasonable from their point of view, but it's just a bad match.
Yeah, great. Yeah, so I think definitely we've found ourselves in situations where there hasn't been a great alignment between kind of where our area of expertise is and kind of how we approach things and potentially what the client's expecting from us as well. So I think out of that, if anything, we've had to learn, I guess, to have a bit of bravery of saying no, to go, hey, actually, we could help you here, but I think you're going to be better served by someone else, and like we'll happily kind of refer that onto someone. And I think ultimately that allows everyone to kind of stay in their lane and do what they do and enjoy what they do without, you know, sometimes the additional stress that comes where there's poor alignment or poor communication. And so I think we've just learned to really value that, as it, you know, not only is so much like a much better experience for the client, but not only for like us as well and for our staff and for our team, like, you know, running a business and doing a job at times is obviously difficult. There's lots of things to manage. There's lots of things on the to-do list. And, you know, if you can do it without the additional stress of someone who's unhappy or, you know, I think that that's a wise thing to do. And it ultimately makes for a better experience for everyone. And I think where there's good alignment, the final product is that much better too. So
no, that's great. That's really great advice. Particularly I like the making it clear to the potential client that you are saying no because of your concerns, outlaying the concerns, and passing them on to somebody else who might be a better fit. So referring them on to someone who might be a better fit. And that, if that's done well, that actually indicates that you care about their success. You care about their success so much that you're willing to say, we're not the right person to help you do whatever it is that you're looking to do.
Yeah, I think so. And like at times as well, obviously we're in a bit of a crazy season, you know, recording this. Well, you're just about to exit kind of your lockdown, but I'm still in Melbourne Metro and we're in the middle of quite a restrictive lockdown period, curfews and limits on your travel and everything like that. And I think because of that, we've had quite a lot on our plate, but even we've had people approaching us wanting help, whether it's for running ad campaigns or setting a project up really quick. And we've just had to be really transparent about them and say, although we'd really love to help you, I think there even could be alignment here. Unfortunately, we've already made commitments to X, Y, and Z client. We've made these promises. We want to deliver on that. We don't want to let them down. And we don't necessarily want to say yes to you only to let you down as well. So giving people really clear indications of what you can do and when you can do it, I think is a very similar thing. It's showing up honestly. And I think when we've been able to do that, people have just so appreciated that. And I think if anything, it just builds goodwill, and who knows what might happen if that kind of turns around, you know, in the future, as opportunities might come through then.
That's right. Because you've basically started to build a relationship, even though it's been predicated on having to say no. But because of the way you've done that, and you've done it in a way that shows that you really do care about the potential client's success, that's actually building on the relationship.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, I know you're a big fan of minimalist design, and yet, you know, if I look at your website, I mean, it looks really attractive without having a lot of over-the-top design, I'd like to call it. So talk to us a little bit about that, because I'm fascinated. You know, there's in the past, I mentioned earlier about some of the work we've done where, you know, it hasn't been a good fit for us in hindsight. I haven't perhaps recognized that right up front. One of those examples falls into the category of what I like to say, where people look at a website and they say, can you change this font to this other font, which is almost the same, but you know, it's got a different name, but apart from that, it looks about 99% the same. And can you move this little image about five pixels to the left, because it looks better when it's 5 pixels to the left? And I find that really frustrating, because I always ask, well, what's that going to do to the customer's experience or your website visitor's experience? So talk to us a little bit about your design philosophy and this idea of the minimalist design.
Yeah,
and how you make that look, how you still make that look good, because clearly, you know, what you were telling us earlier, you are a fan of good design.
Absolutely. Yeah, thank you for the compliment on the website. I feel like websites nowadays particularly are always in beta. They're always in change. There's always those little areas of improvement. And so I think on some level, we do try and take that philosophy of change. I think not only does that give us a level of freedom to I guess, make a design live, and that we don't have to have the perfect design or the perfect website or anything like that, I think it gives us this freedom to always improve. And I think that's a really kind of healthy mindset of always improving rather than perfecting it and leaving it. And so I guess that's part of how we approach our design in that way. I think broadly, you know, this idea of minimalism or simplicity, you'd probably guess who I'm thinking of when I'm going to reference these guys. Obviously, they're the biggest company in the world, Apple. And what they've been able to do through their design principles is just quite amazing. I think it shows that you don't need to be overly complicated, and that I think, if anything, Apple is a brilliant marketing company and they really understand people. Steve Jobs was always on about the kind of user experience and how people, you know, would intuitively pick up and understand their kind of products. I even heard a story about, I think it was someone who was using an iPad, but they're like a two-year-old in Central America. So very low kind of education, very low technology adoption. Yet this two-year-old, three-year-old was able to pick up an iPad and know exactly what they were doing within a couple of minutes. And I think that's just incredible, that interface, that way of interacting with the world made sense to this infant. And I think that's the power of good design, is it just works. It doesn't need a PhD to be able to interpret it. It doesn't need, you know, someone to be wearing a hat, so to speak, to understand how it works. I think in that way, good design is democratic in that it's accessible to all people. I think if, you know, your design is exclusive or it only speaks to a certain type of market, I think perhaps that's a strategic decision that you are trying to speak specifically to those people. But I think for a lot of people, for most general people, it's probably just a matter of not really considering the person on the other end. You know, it's going, oh yeah, cool, that'll work, but not really considering the other. And I think that's ultimately what good design does, is it just considers. It considers the other. It considers, if I'm on this website, what am I seeing? Does this make sense to me? If I want to contact, is this relatively easy to do? You know, I was with someone not too long ago, and I guess as a web designer, I spend a lot of time building websites and in web platforms, and I could not for the life of me work out how to buy a product on this person's website. And I'm going, oh, like, I know you've got an online store, but it's just not making sense to me. And I think if someone like myself is really struggling to do that, I think that probably shows a lot. And so, yeah, I mean, does that kind of answer your question there?
Yeah, it does. And, you know, I can relate to that experience. I had one recently where I wanted to buy a bottle of wine for my son. Mm-hmm. He lives in San Francisco, and I wanted to buy him a bottle of wine from a winery in Sonoma where we'd visited together a couple of years back. And so there was a connection there. I knew the wine. I knew mm-hmm. the wine I wanted. So it was a bit of an emotional connection. So I was motivated to actually go through all the pain of actually buying this wine. I got this company clearly had only just thrown together this online store. I mean, it was definitely a thrown together online store. Uh-huh. So they'd probably not had online sales before. It was all cellar door or through retail outlets. And because of COVID, obviously, they decided we'll do some online stuff. And so I thought, okay, I can order this wine. So first of all, I had to fill in all the details, and before I got to the credit card thing. And then it just rejected my details because my postal code was only 4 characters.
Right. So,
and it was all set up for just a US thing, even though you could select different country, you could select any country from the world from the mm-hmm. country drop down. But the postal code thing was set up that it had to be the 5 letters. So I knew that because I knew from my experience in the US, I thought, okay, I'll just put a 0 in front. The 0 in front, of course, didn't work because there are no postcodes beginning with 0 in the US. So I thought of one that represented the state and thought they're just going to get a bogus postcode. So it accepted the bogus postcode. Wow. Then it actually wanted a phone number mm-hmm. of the person being delivered to, which I had, and my phone number. Now, the format of the phone number field wasn't clear. And I put in my son's phone number mm-hmm. and it just kept rejecting it because it was the wrong format. So I went through about 5 iterations to figure out the format and I couldn't figure it out. And eventually I went down to the footer of their website, copied their phone number that they had in the footer because I figured that's probably the format that they're using, pasted that in there and then just changed the number itself. And then it accepted the number. I thought, right, got it. And then when I went to my number, of course, whilst I had the right number of digits, it said, no, it can't start with that number, you know, because there's no such phone number. So I was looking for it. So, yeah, and as I say, because there was this emotional connection and I really wanted to get this wine for him and I knew it'd be, you know, he'd really value this because it would be a special gift, not just because it was a bottle of wine. I persisted, and I think it took me about an hour, and I eventually just gave them their own phone number as my phone number, and I thought mm-hmm. that's gonna have to do because they won't call me anyway. And then I ordered it. Now luckily it was 2 bottles of wine. Luckily they actually arrived. the order went through, but I thought, man, how many people would they have lost there because their online shop is just bad? And all it takes is for somebody from the business to actually go through and order something online, realize how bad the the experience is and say, no, we've got to fix this.
Yeah. I think, I mean, well done on persevering. I think you need a trophy for that. But I think that's the thing, which is, I mean, even in that story, I just hear so much, like, obviously what they were able to do, they'd kind of captured this emotional experience that you'd had with your son. You were ready to purchase, and on a brand level, on a product level, it was all really clear. And then what really let you down was just a technical design issue, a user experience issue that had nothing necessarily to do with the brand, but now all of a sudden you're associating the frustration of this checkout experience with the brand. And perhaps next time you're not going to, well, maybe now that you've worked out their system, you might endure, but I think, you know, it might be a, you know, an incentive to turn somewhere else because of that experience. And I think you've just hit the nail on the head. I think sometimes, you know, in a business or in a company, you're speaking at a level of 10, or you've got an assumed knowledge level of a 10, and your customers are at a 1 or a 2, you know, and you really need to be able to bridge that gap between where you are and where your customer is. And sometimes we dumb it down a little bit, or we simplify it a little bit, but, you know, bring it from a 10 to a 7, and there's still a big gap there. And we're just kind of fingers crossed, hoping that people will be able to make that jump, which is, I guess, in what your case you've described is they've been able to make something work hypothetically, I guess, and you've been willing to go through the frustration and the process to make that jump. But it's very likely that other people in a similar situation wouldn't have done that. And in some level, it's leaving money on the table, not because your product's not amazing, not because you haven't invested, you know, into your brand, because you've built a reputation, because you've got an amazing, you know, retail experience. It's those small little things that can really let you down, unfortunately. And I think it's those things where people assume, I guess, that they just should work. And I think we've been trained to assume that that kind of checkout process should be easy and simple. And when it's not, it's, you know, it really steers us in the other direction.
Yeah, I mean, another one that I've come across from time to time, and then I've done what you alluded to earlier. I've gone to the next website that sells the same thing, which is finding out postage costs.
Yep.
And a lot of online stores, you know, there's postage costs involved if it's delivered from some other location. But a lot of shop websites give you that just before you're about to check out, and you're virtually committed. You're like, it's not only in your shopping basket, it's like you've committed to buy before you actually get told, here's what the postage is. And sometimes, you know, the postage could be $50 on one side and $10 on another side. So that's clearly going to affect your decision to go with one or the other, assuming that the price of the item you're purchasing is very similar.
I know. It is funny, because in a, you know, again, like if we were to translate that to a real world retail experience, imagine bringing something up to the counter and then there's just a random, like, additional charge, you know, oh, it's $50 extra if you want to buy this thing, or it's $10 extra, and you don't know until you're ready to buy. And that, if that was to happen in a...
Until they've rung up the register, basically, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, that would be a terrible experience. Mm. Everyone would be like, what are you doing? And I think it's like some of those things is it's like, you know, having that unknown factor, or that what is it going to be? Is it going to be in my budget? Is it within my expectations? I think sometimes that can create a level of fear. And so I think based on the data that we see is that, you know, if people don't know the shipping before they enter the cart flow, there's going to be a much, much higher abandoned cart rate on the end, because people are going to get there and go, oh, this is way too much, I'm not going to bother here. Whereas, you know, setting the expectation, $10 Australia-wide or $10 nationwide, or, you know, being really clear about what it is regarding shipping, then people were actually factoring that into their decision. Whereas in the example you gave, it's like you'd kind of made a decision and then all of a sudden you're just about to check out and new information is being brought to you. And that kind of changes what you, what decision you thought you were making. On some level, you're making a new decision. And so it's all those little things that I think in a, that maybe we assume is common sense in a retail environment. I think that's partly because we've had so much experience in a retail environment. We've, you know, gone to shops with our parents. We've gone there ourselves, you know, with our families and so on. We kind of know what to expect and the shopkeepers know what to expect. And it's a little bit like as we're entering into this e-commerce, I guess it's you could already call it a revolution, but I think it's only going to continue to grow and change how we buy. But I think a lot of those common sense, you know, implications and expectations that we know from a retail environment haven't quite been clarified in a digital environment yet. And I think kind of what you're explaining is that there are still a lot of factors where they can cause frustration or confusion or fear. And I think whenever those factors are at play around a decision-making process, I think it's definitely important for, I guess, business owners and designers and developers to pay attention.
Yeah, I like your analogies. I mean, you were giving me one before we started recording, but that one there where, you know, you turn up with the item in the department store, you turn up with the item at the checkout counter and the cash register, and they ring up a number and then add a charge to it that you weren't aware of beforehand. So that I think it's good to relate things back to that experience that people kind of understand at that level, whereas on the online store they think it's just a case of putting up an image and a payment gateway and connecting the two so that people pay out. But it's certainly really around the experience, the shopping experience, and you can use that metaphor of what would it be like in the store. Would you do that in the store? I suspect most people would say no. I'd be disappointed in the business that said, oh yeah, why not?
Oh, exactly. And I think that's the thing. I think if you look at what online stores do well, there's definitely a theme and there's definitely a lot of process and a lot of indications and nudges that push people in the right direction, whether that is like call to actions or whether that's the type of photography that they use, you know, what kind of information they're providing. All of that plays this massive role in terms of what brings people over the line. And I think what is interesting too is that we're definitely seeing, I guess, retail become omni-channel. It's, I find something on Instagram, I check it out on the website, and perhaps then I actually go into the store to touch and feel. But then, you know, I'm not quite sure whether I want to buy it right there and now, but then I'll come back to the online store and maybe I'll use an Afterpay or, you know, buy now, pay later type of scheme. So I think that's really quite interesting too, the actual process that people walk through around making a purchase decision, what you'd call perhaps the information gathering stage has really increased. I think, in the marketing world, you'd call it cognitive dissonance around making a purchase and then going, oh, I've made the wrong choice. I don't, you know, what am I going to do now? And I think people are really, you know, anxious about making a bad purchase decision. And so they get more information, they read the reviews, they, you know, watch the YouTube video, they come in and check it out in store. And I think, you know, across all of those experiences, I guess business owners really need to be aware of how those touch points really contribute to an overall experience. You know, because while you're maybe in store, you understand that experience and you have control over that. But, you know, and this is, I guess, similar to your example with the winery. I'm assuming it was a lovely winery. You had a great time there.
Absolutely, yeah.
they were in control of the experience, and they were able to do that really well. And then all of a sudden, terrible experience online. And so I think we always have to be thinking about how are people engaging with us outside of that immediate, like, they're here in my store. Or, you know, the opposite's true. Perhaps an amazing online experience, and you're saying that you're this great, friendly, proactive brand, that you've got brilliant customer service, and then they jump into your store and there's a lousy sales assistant, or they're grumpy, or things are dusty, or there's just that, you know, there's not quite the alignment between what you're saying you are and what you actually are when they reference it. And I think whenever that exists, it creates distrust. It's like, oh, are these people really who they say they are? And so I think that is definitely something that we need to consider moving forward. And I think, you know, again, if we were to take it right back to, like, the minimalism and design and how we approach what we do, I think, you know, for our clients, when we can meet them, fingers crossed, maybe in a month or two, that when they experience us on our website, that they actually get the same experience in person, that we are who we say we are. And I think, you know, particularly in this type of time, it's really easy to say something and not back it up. And I think people do really appreciate people who are genuine and honest and actually have the integrity, whether it's just in a service type of business or in a product type of business or in this omni-channel kind of retail environment that we find ourselves in. It's integrity of brand across all of those touch points, really.
Yeah, that's a really important point. And, you know, we have this exercise we do in our marketing program called The Lighthouse at the beginning, which is really being clear about what you stand for and who you actually work for. And the lighthouse metaphor is then that, you know, that light that you shine is consistent regardless of what the external environment is. And that's the guiding thing right throughout the whole lot. So it's all throughout, you know, whether that's what you're saying on your website, whether that's what you're saying when you meet people in person or when they come into your store and so on. So really good point.
Yeah, I think another thing which is quite funny, I won't take too long, but it's kind of a pet peeve of mine, but when particularly service businesses say they're professional and they kind of use professionalism or expertise as a bit of a, you know, a lighthouse, as a guiding value. But it's like it's coming into a time where that's the bare minimum. Like, I really hope you're professional. Like, I want more than that. You know what I mean? So I think having values outside of the obvious, like, oh, we're going to be good at what we do, or we're going to be professional, or things like that, which on some level have really lost their weight because
it's expectation, isn't it? I mean, it's like, the poker, is it poker where you play and there's table stakes? So unless you've put the table stakes on the table, you don't play. You can't play. And so, yeah, professionalism, or we know what we're doing, and that's all table stakes.
Yeah, exactly.
And then, you know, and then once you get to the table, okay, well, what's different about you? Mm-hmm. What's unique?
Yeah, definitely. I think even just from a positioning point of view, I guess in our experience doing a lot of brand work, is it's, to say you're professional is quite a boring thing to say now. You know, it's like, I think people have come to, you know, it's like, you know, again, expectations, but people expect the checkout process to be easy. And when it's frustrating, it's like, oh, what's going, this isn't how it should be. And I think that's the same here, is that we have expectations now, and it's like, well, yes, like if you're in business and this is how you're doing and you're bringing service or you're selling products, like we expect it to work or to be good, to say, to do what you say you will. And, you know, adding those additional values and things just really helps separate you and actually position yourself different in the market.
Yeah, good message. All right. Well, I'm just cognizant of the time here, and I, you know, I could go on chatting customer experience online for ages, and I know we've got sort of similar views, so probably lots of stories to share there, but I am watching the clock a little bit, so I think it's a good point to move on to the buzz, which is our innovation round, and it's designed to help our audience who are primarily innovators and leaders in their field with some tips from your experience. So I've got five questions, and hopefully you'll give us some answers that will inspire the listener to go and do something awesome today as a result.
Great.
What's the number one thing you think anyone needs to do to be more innovative?
Yeah, I think I would maybe put it to two little elements. I think what I would call maybe appreciation first. And I think out of appreciation, out of thankfulness, you can really find this place of curiosity. Wondering why, how does this work? Why is this how it is? What if we did this? And I think kind of carrying that type of approach, not only to work, but just in life in general, being like a bit curious, a bit childlike in that way, I think is just a real valuable way of discovering new perspectives and coming up with ideas or seeing opportunities for things that otherwise you wouldn't have seen. So that's kind of what I'd put there.
Yeah, I love it. Curiosity, I mean, that's one of my favorite words in terms of innovation, you know, sort of saying, oh, well, why did that happen? I'm curious to understand that. And I love the idea of coming out of gratitude, because that means you can actually quickly reframe something that might be at first a negative experience. So taking my example of the bad checkout experience, rather than getting frustrated and annoyed, turning it around and saying, well, I'm grateful that I can actually get a hold of this wine from a distance and ship it to my son. So I'm curious now how can we improve this experience? I actually did go back to the winery and say, hey, you know, I told them the story and I said, hey, you might want to think about doing something here.
Yeah. And I think having that approach is better for everyone too. Like if you'd had maybe a negative approach, it's like, oh, I'll leave a bad review or I'll, you know, tell all my friends what a terrible thing. And I think appreciating that, you know, you can send a gift to someone across the other side of the world. That's an amazing thing. And, you know, but I think approaching that, you go, oh, like, what about this? What about this? What about this? And I think, yeah, it becomes generative in that way.
Great. All right. Now, what's the best thing you've done to develop new ideas?
I think practically, like, it is probably that curiosity of spirit, just going, how does this work? Why does this happen? And I think with that, just again, it's kind of been a bit of a theme in our conversation, but wondering how this impacts someone else, you know. And I think when you're kind of pulling together curiosity and how can I help somebody, you know, how can I make their experience better? What are they feeling in this kind of process? I think putting those two things together is really powerful, because A, you're kind of in the human side of things, you're understanding a need, you're understanding a desire, you're understanding an opportunity that potentially people would like a solution for. And then being curious about it kind of helps you develop different pathways to finding solutions for it. And I think that creative thinking or divergent thinking, when you're pairing that with a real core desire to help people, you can come up with some really innovative solutions rather than just kind of sticking in your rut going, oh, well, this is the only solution we have, you know, you better just deal with it. And it's, I think that kind of thinking, it doesn't really add anything, you know. So there will always be that kind of solution. But I think, you know, when you're really considering people and what the impact is there for them, and I think that will always be valued.
So getting out of your own skin and having some empathy for others and looking at, you know, how's the experience going to be for the person using it or for the other person that I'm trying to help? Yeah, love it. Okay, now what's a favorite resource of yours that you use a lot?
I'm a big reader. I love reading books. Actually, I'm a bit of a podcast binger too, to be honest. But I think I would have to say, yeah, Book Depository. That is a massive resource. I think I'm always waiting on a book to come in the mail. So I really love reading. I love hearing about people's stories.
So do
And
you
yeah,
read hard copies or paper copies? Yeah, not digital.
No, I think very rarely I'll read a digital copy, but there's something quite nice about having a hard copy and being able to pass it on to someone or, leave it kind of lying around the house. So I think that's just been really great to understand that. I wouldn't say there's been, any major resource in particular that I've looked to. But I think again, like this element of curiosity to go, oh, what about this? Or where did this come from? Or what can I learn from this? And I think having that curiosity allows you to always learn. And I think it's easy to go, oh no, I'm good, I know this, or I have this. And really it's just robbing yourself of an opportunity to learn something. So I think the biggest resource is probably just going, huh, what can I learn today?
So, do you have a good book recommendation for us? One that you've read
Oh
recently?
yes, I this would be an interesting book recommendation. It's Failure of Nerve by Edwin Friedman. So
Not familiar with that one.
not familiar with that one? Yeah, it's basically he was a systems theorist and really fascinating kind of guy. And basically, I think the byline of the book is Leadership in the Age of the Quick Fix. And he talks a lot about how, in basically, he talks about anxiety being a major underpinning factor in culture. And when society is chronically anxious, they actually move towards quick fixes, black and white thinking, blaming, herd mentality, and, I think it wouldn't take much to maybe see some of that play out in different countries around the world, in our own kind of, councils and governments and things. But this idea that when people are anxious, they want to blame. They want to say, this is your fault. Whereas Friedman basically argues what's most transformative in that for a system, whether it's a marriage or it's a business or it's a community or it's a country, is actually having people who are what he calls non-anxious presences. How do you separate yourself from the problems while not completely separating yourself as to detach from it, but to walk the tension between the black and white? Because it's never black or white. It's always both of these things. And there's obviously personal responsibility as well as what other people have contributed to the situation. And so a few people I know call it the best leadership book they've ever read. I really enjoyed it, so I think that would be my recommendation.
Sounds fascinating. Yeah. Well, you've sold me, so I'm going to go and check it out afterwards.
Yeah, awesome.
All right. Now, what's the best way to keep a project on track?
Very good question. I think I'll take any suggestions. If anyone's got some amazing, like how to make projects work 100% of the time, all of the time. I think what we've found is, again, curiosity, like how can we improve this? What does this mean for the client? What does this mean for us? What does this mean for our team? I think bringing that through has been really helpful. And so, again, learning on the job, learning how to improve what we're doing every day. I think practically for us, we use Asana, which is a project management tool. We've templated work, we've got automations running, we've got a whole bunch of stuff that really works as a system. And that's been so valuable, not only to get a roadmap and understand where we're at with any single project at any one point in time, but also give basically clarity to our whole organization around what people are doing, what importance is assigned to what they're doing, So I think in that as well, it's just been so valuable to have that clarity. And I think that would be a really important thing for the team to go, oh, okay, like I can see Marcel's busy working on this. He's got so much going on. It's all due in the next day. Maybe I won't ask him to jump in to do this kind of thing. So I think, again, that's been really great. And then practically, one thing we're experimenting with at the moment in terms of our design and development sprints is to spend 50% of our week on any one project. And so giving a really big chunk of our time to a single project, and we've found that to be so valuable in moving things forward. I think sometimes it's easy to get distracted with email or the next notification or the next little job or request. And so, you know, and I think in that when you're doing so many little tasks, often at the end of the day, you're just feeling exhausted, overwhelmed, and I didn't really complete anything today. Yeah. Just checked my email 100 times. And so I think we've really got into this idea of what Cal Newport would call deep work, which is shut out all the notifications, shut out all the distractions, give your time and your attention to the things that are most important. And that's been so valuable for us.
Yeah, I like the idea of dedicating essentially half your work week to one project, because then you know that you're actually, if you're doing the right work on that project, you know that you're really moving the needle on that one. And I assume that you're rotating those projects over time. So the next week it'll be a different project.
Yeah. I think as well.
Sorry?
I was just going to say too, like, I think we've just found that, you know, there's been a lot of talk about mental health in lockdowns and the COVID season. And I think we've found people being able to walk away from the end of the day feeling like they've moved the needle on something is just really, really positive experience. Like, I've done something today, I've moved something forward. And yeah, there's real dividend in that.
Yes, it definitely is. And I had ran an event for our local community here yesterday that I tried to do a networking event with breakout rooms and actually really generate some deep connections and deep and meaningful discussions. And I was kind of nervous up front about the whole thing, but it went off beautifully. You know, there was lots of great feedback and everybody loved the event. And it was kind of at the end of the day. So once I shut everything down at the end of the day, I thought, oh, I feel really great now. I've achieved something. So you're right. If you've kind of moved the needle on one thing, that really kind of, you feel really grateful. You've kind of done something today and achieved something.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, well, I think we've touched on this before, but I'll ask the question anyway. What's the number one thing anyone can do to differentiate themselves?
Oh, the number one thing. I have a group of friends who are in business, and they would probably suggest to be yourself. I think coming down to it, no one is you. You are uniquely you. And I think on that level, yeah, building a business around yourself, I guess it maybe has its pros and cons. I've seen it done well. I've seen it done poorly. But I think definitely that can add some value in terms of differentiating yourself. But I think, like maybe we mentioned earlier, is if you're not really clear on what your values are or why you do what you do, I think spending some time really articulating what you want to achieve, but like why you want to achieve what you want to achieve, and actually how you're going to do it. Like, am I trying to create $1 million business and try and make as much money as I can? Or am I really interested in doing that with people and valuing people and caring for people and helping them and their family and so on? Or am I just going to treat them as tools to help me achieve my goal? And I think being really clear about how you want to do what you want to do and then leading with why you're doing it that way, I think people will always appreciate. I think, you know, as a as a human race, we're just so fascinated with stories and the motives behind the motives, so to speak. And I think there's definitely value there in leading with why. I think people can get behind a vision that doesn't just serve yourself.
That's right. And also it kind of, there's that connection there, and we've spoken quite a bit about that human connection and considering the other person's point of view. So I think that's all encapsulated in that, being really clear about what you help. And the paradox is that, and I can't remember who said this, it might have been Zig Ziglar, who originally came up with this quote, and said, if you want to earn more money, help more people. So the paradox is, if you focus on helping people rather than making money, you probably end up being more successful in terms of financial success.
Definitely, because ultimately, people pay you to solve a problem, right? Whether that's a product problem, I need a new toothbrush, or I have no idea how to do my tax. Whatever it is, people have problems, and I think you can't remove the problem from the people, because without people, there wouldn't be problems, correct?
Yeah, that's right. All right. Well, thanks, Marcel. This has been really great. Now, where can people find out more about you and what you do, and maybe have a look at some of your work?
Yeah, probably the best place to do that is to visit our website, which is 12.com.au. But the spelling, onetoo.com.au.
All right. And we'll make sure we post a link in the show notes as well, so just in case people forget the spelling. And do you have some parting advice for our listener today?
I think probably what I would say, in one way to bring a conclusion or a summary to our conversation is to really value other people and to consider them in the process and consider their problems. Consider how they feel about their problems and what it means for them to have their problem solved. And really just being curious about that. I think it would be easy to assume that you know what problem they have and how it should be solved. But I think taking the time to get curious, to ask questions, to know what their experience of a problem being solved is, I think will only bring about really valuable insight. I think that would be a great place to start.
I love it. And also I love that you said, how they feel about their problem or their situation. I think that's a really key part of empathy, not just sort of being analytical about it, but how do people feel about their current situation? How do they want to be feeling, and how is your solution to their problem going to help them feel this desired feeling, or what's it going to make them feel?
You're absolutely right. I think sometimes we like to treat people like they're robots. But it's like, practically it's like, here's a t-shirt. You need a t-shirt. You're cold. Have a t-shirt. But if all we needed practically was a t-shirt, why are there all these crazy brands? Why are there all these, $500 or $1,000 t-shirts? Like, people want to feel something when their problem's being solved. They're buying more than the solution. They're buying, the products in this case is definitely solving more than a practical problem. It's an emotional problem that is potentially being solved at the same time.
Yeah, I love it. All right, now who else should I get on the Innova Buzz podcast and why?
Ooh, very good question. I've got a suggestion here. It might be a bit of an interesting one, but I guess a friend down here who runs a lot of craft markets, and what they've been able to do in terms of building a brand and a community around makers and creators has been really quite fun, and we've had the pleasure of kind of helping them. So that's for Vanessa Johnson of the Emu Plains Market. And I think they've just got such a great value around creating really positive and amazing experiences for a lot of people, but as well as running a number of markets in the Mornington Peninsula kind of region. They also have a retail store in Mornington. And if there's something cool and quirky and creative, they're going to be there.
Hmm. All right. Well, we'll get an intro to Vanessa from you and look forward to having a conversation with her. Sounds like we've got lots to talk about, particularly around the experiences and the creativity angle.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks so much for sharing your time and your insights with us so generously today, Marcella. This has been wonderful. I've really enjoyed it. There's been lots of great tips and advice for people to reflect on and think about that I think applies across the board to any business, not just business involved in design and building websites or building e-commerce stores. But I think, you know, the idea of thinking about the customer experience from the point of view of the customer and maybe even walking through your own customer experience as a customer. I came across something that somebody had posted and I thought that's actually brilliant, which was the idea of, I mean, that there's secret shoppers that go around into stores and just buy stuff and then report back on the experience. And that's a business because that business then reports back to where those shoppers have shopped and said, here's what was reported back by the secret shoppers. Here's their experience. And I see there's people actually doing that now online or on, you know, in different things like going and visiting a bunch of websites and saying, here's what the experience was on the website. So that's a great thing to reflect on. You know, what's the user experience? So I think there's been lots of great tips today. So thanks again, Marcel. All the best for the future and let's stay in touch.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed that informative and delightful conversation with Marcel and took something away from his episode. His focus on curiosity and always learning and improving definitely resonated with me. And we didn't even get to talk about bicycles and coffee. I'd love to know what you took away from Marcel's episode. Leave a comment below the blog post, which you can find at innovabiz.co/Marcel McCarthy. That is MarcelMcCarthy. All lowercase, all one word, innovabiz.co/Marcel McCarthy. You'll also find contact information for getting in touch with Marcel there, as well as links to the 1-2 website, his social media pages, and the other resources we spoke about in today's conversation. Marcel suggested that we have a conversation with Vanessa Johnson of Emu Plains Markets on a future InnovaBuzz podcast episode. So Vanessa, keep an eye on your inbox for an invitation from us to the InnovaBuzz podcast courtesy of Marcel McCarthy. Tune in again to the next episodes of the InnovaBuzz podcast where we've got yet more fantastic guests lined up, including personal branding expert Tamara Glick and Simon Severino of Strategy Sprints. Thanks for listening to this episode. Make sure you subscribe to the show to be reminded of new episodes. It's free to subscribe. Leave a review if you like. Even if you don't like me, I'm okay with that. I'm asking you to leave a review because it helps other people find this show. Go to innovabiz.co to join our marketing transformation community and access a free gift my team and I made for you. It's the Marketing Master Mini Class. We want to give you everything you need to transform your marketing into a human-centered, relationship-focused growth engine. Until next time, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Remember, be awesome and keep innovating.